Live from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null, broadcasting and video streaming live from our studios in New York City, and I welcome you. You can also, if you're away at noon Eastern Standard Time, listen to this broadcast over a telephone, any listening device. Write down this number, because you never know when you're going to need it. And this way, you can be anywhere in North America or Canada. As long as you call this number, you'll be able to get the listening for that full hour. I'll give you that in a moment. Also, you can watch today's program by going to Ustream channel and then search for Gary Null. Good news, I have posted over 100 self-empowering health videos. Everything from alternative approaches to depression and fibromyalgia and arthritis and heart disease and elevated blood pressure and lowering your cholesterol and losing weight and exercising and cooking and how to cook and raw foods, all that is in there. And it's free. It's as a public service. It's also very short. Why? Because a lot of people don't spend a lot of time now reading. So I produced these, I narrated them, filmed them in short 4 to 7 minute segment. I think the longest one's 11 minutes. And I will be posting at least 500 of these within the next 2 to 3 weeks. We already have 100 up now. You can go to YouTube, Gary Null, they're there. Or you can go to Ustream channel, they're there. Look for Gary Null. The phone number to call into and listen live is 712-755-6850. 712-755-6850. Now, today, we're going to talk about the latest in health and healing, because that's a universal, important issue. Everyone wants to be healthy as long as they can, and if they're sick, look at the most natural ways, non-toxic, least invasive ways of getting well. We'll share that with you today. For example, what can slow down the aging process? How to beat cancer? How to help your heart with your emotions? Also, for those of you who ask about whey powder, what does it do? Well, I'll tell you what it does, positive and negative. And also some new research that is showing that Gardasil is even worse than what we had assumed it was. My guest in the second part of our program today to address a lot of what the major media, including the BBC and Al Jazeera seems to have a quick dial to the Brookings Institute or the Heritage Foundation or the Council on Foreign Relations. All of those people, bright as they are, connected politically, socially, economically successful, are all extremely biased. They are the neocons. These are the war supporters. Now, they may fully believe in their position, but they're wrong. So I'm having Ray McGovern on today to talk about Russia versus ISIS and the Obama's ethical dilemma in his war on terrorism, but also a commentary today, an insightful commentary about the imperialist ruling class in our world today by Paul Street of Counterpunch. And also I'll be sharing some additional insights from the radically changing story of the U.S. airstrike on an Afghan hospital from Glenn Greenwald. So we have a lot to talk about. Let's begin. And just so you understand, this is the number one listened to progressive radio program in the world, and has been for a long time, the number one listened to health program in the world. We're worldwide. We have a lot of local stations carry us from a wonderful station up in Woodstock that has a lot of very progressive people listening. I was just up there 2 weeks ago. And in Florida and West Virginia, all over America. But our themes are universal themes. That's why frequently you hear me having guests on or talking about issues that could affect you if you lived in Norway, not just in Brooklyn. Also, we have a lot of young people listening. In fact, our demographics show that the average listener to this program is a 37-year-old, college-educated woman listening from home at night after work on the downloads. 99.9% of all of the people listening to the show downloaded. So it's a whole different ball game. And so we're trying to address as many of their needs as possible. And a lot of them like to know about the investigative reports, the white papers, the universal issues on human rights. That's what they gear into. A lot just want health and nutrition. So we try to balance it. Always the largest portion is on health and nutrition. One other thing, for my hardest-hitting programs, those that are uncompromising in intensity of issue and context, it's the Progressive Commentary Hour. That's every Tuesday evening, 7 o'clock. And then we have a whole series we do called Conversations with Remarkable Minds. These are one-on-one conversations with some of the most brain insightful, problem-solving people on the planet. We have about 500 of those. So there's no shortage of people who can get information if they need it. One thing we all need to slow down a bit so we can slow down the aging process. But in our extremely frenetic, fast-paced lives, highly stressed lives, we sometimes leave out what is most important for the aging process: exercise. If you eat a perfect diet, take all your supplements, have all your juices, have the right amount of good alkalizing foods and organic, you would still not put more than about 35% of what is positive for health and healing and slowing the aging process. That's it, about 35%. So that means you still have 65%. And that's why some of the sickest people I know shop in health food stores, because if all they're going to do is go have their juice, nothing else, or just their vitamins, nothing else, or just eat organic and nothing else, they're missing it. Big time is exercise. That's a full, straight on, about 15% to 20%. If you don't over-exercise, if you don't overdo it, which is very easy to do. Exercising by doing about an hour a day, that includes your loosening up and slowing down. You never just stop running or biking because that throws your heart into a shock position. You could have a heart attack. Instead, you have to graduate into your workout, peak, and then graduate down, then cool down where you're still slowly exercising, getting your slow stretches in. That's the ideal way of doing it. Now, you can do a variety, and I suggest cross-training, meaning aerobic, could be power walking or jogging, could be swimming. Power biking means you put it into the most resistant gear where you really have to strain your body in order to get those pedals moving. You never use your light gears. You don't really get an, it's called a junk workout if you do that. And then you want to do resistance exercises. The two together, resistance and aerobic, in any good combination, 6 days a week. Here's the latest on this, and this is from Ball State University. Quote, the average American loses about 10% of cardiorespiratory fitness a decade after 20. Quote, reference standards for cardiorespiratory fitness measured by cardiopulmonary exercise testing shows this, and the study provides the first true reference standards for interpreting measured cardiorespiratory fitness, allowing the healthcare community to help people as they age. And so, improved fitness might add years onto your life. I'm quoting directly from the study. While cardiovascular disease is the number one killer of Americans, Professor Kaminsky pointed out that relatively small improvements in cardiovascular fitness also have been associated with reductions in mortality of up to 25%. The study published in the Mayo Clinic Proceedings, one of the nation's peer-reviewed premier clinical journals, looked at 7,800 participants and followed them for a long period of time. And what they found is that the more physically active a person was, the longer they lived, the less heart disease they had. How simple is that? So historically, we've done just the opposite. We say, well, you're getting older, slow down, take it easy. Wrong. We've said, well, don't stress yourself. You know, wrong. you know, spend more time in a rocking chair and hanging out. Wrong. Just the opposite. The older you get, the more vigorous you should become, the more exercise you should apply to, because you're slowing down the aging process, you're producing more human growth hormone, you're managing your hormone levels better, you're better at maintaining the pulse of the heart, keeping your blood pressure in a more normal range, all of which allow you to live a longer life. Can hot peppers beat cancer? This is from the University of Bath in the United Kingdom. Quote, recent evidence and lab-based tests have shown that capsaicin, one of the main ingredient molecules in chilies, responsible for their fiery hot taste, may have anti-cancer properties. And this was done through the Worldwide Cancer Research at the University of Bath. And this is what they showed. So I've looked at dozens of studies on capsaicin. And here is what you have to know. It may taste hot, but it's not burning you. To the contrary, it's actually turning off inflammation in your gut, in your stomach, in your intestines, in your muscles. So hence it helps you with arthritis, fibromyalgia. It helps you if you have cancer, all cancers, everywhere in the body, macular degeneration and cataracts. Anything that causes oxidative stress, which causes free radicals, this helps in part to negate. So we should be having capsaicin at any, well, you have to test yourself. There's the low heat index, the medium heat index, and the hot heat index. Your best advantage is at the hot heat index because it also helps to separate the red blood cells. Therefore, there's less clumping. Therefore, there's less chance of a stroke. So I believe that if you were to take before and after every exercise, one capsule of a high heat index capsaicin, you would prevent heart attack and stroke substantially. If you were to take it before you go to bed at night, because most people are not aware, a lot of strokes and heart attacks happen while you're sleeping, you could help prevent it overnight. Now, there are other things you can take with it, but just by itself, I believe we could reduce heart attacks and strokes by at least 15%. And if you've had a stroke or a heart attack, it does what those aspirin do, but the aspirin kills over 25,000 Americans a year because of bleeding, and it destroys vitamin C. Aspirin will destroy vitamin C, folic acid, B6, and B12, the very four nutrients you need to prevent from elevated homocysteine, which will then create a heart attack rate. So on the one hand, orthodox cardiology does suggest low-dose aspirin on the one hand, which will reduce your risk of a stroke, but it increases your risk of a heart attack on the other. It's just part of the mindless duality of the orthodox medical model, where if you took capsaicin, it reduces your risk of a heart attack and a stroke and death from bleeding. But no one's patented. You can't, because it's a natural substance. Also, we have a hard time relaxing in America. Just letting ourselves be. We're always trying to work harder, do more, and we pay a price for that, no matter what we achieve in the short term. This is a good study published in Psychosomatic Medicine. Here's what it says. New research has suggested that people who inculcate positive emotions and maintain positivity are less likely to develop any heart disease than those who tend not to be happy. The research conducted at Penn State examined 1,000 patients with coronary heart disease over the course of 5 years and observed that patients who reported higher positive psychological states were more likely to be physically active, sleep better, and take better care of themselves. So, I was having a conversation last evening at there was a film festival, and Poverty Inc. which is on a rip right now, won Best Documentary. That's two in 1 week. And there's a third film festival this week on Poverty Inc. here in New York City. I'll attend it also. The other one was also New York. And I think we've won our finalists right now in 40, which is huge for this one documentary. In any case, there was a discussion between a psychologist, a professor, and we were talking about the nature of relationships. And I have a new manuscript that I'm turning in on this very issue of why aren't we happy? What role does happiness play in health? And my underlying assumption is this: you cannot be healthy until you're happy. You can make efforts. You'll have temporary gains. But to sustain health, you must sustain happiness. Happiness is the foundation upon which health is built. It's not the reverse. And he was arguing, and it was fine. So we had a discussion. It's always healthy. And I always appreciate difference of opinion, especially provided in a congenial manner. And I gave an example. I said, do you realize how many people in the health field are angry, rageful, and they look at something or someone within the health field to bring them relief? And so they're always on this journey. The journey is really seeking some sense of happiness, completeness, but they're using lack of health as their venue. So they're on a venue to lose weight or to overcome their depression or anxiety or heart disease. And if you don't put in there what's wrong in your life, what has been wrong, what can you do to bring happiness back into this moment, even if you didn't have it earlier? If you had stress at one point in your life, if you had trauma, if you had abuse, and most of us do at some level, at some point in our lives, we either come to grips with, okay, I can't change what happened, but I can change that it any longer is going to be a part of my epigenetic being, meaning I'm not going to make any judgments based upon what I was dealt with a long time ago, maybe as a kid when I didn't have any capacity except my emotions to deal with it. But today, what we have are generations, three generations of people, the vast majority of whom are unhappy and trying to seek happiness in the ways you never can, never. Happiness comes from a relationship. No, it doesn't. Ever. Happiness comes from having the right things. Never. Not even for the Cardassians. Happiness comes because I'm successful. Wrong again. To the contrary, success as we measure it in the United States actually leads to it. Instead, I challenge it by saying happiness is a state of consciousness, a state of willful, mindful, spiritual attainment where you're honoring that which you are, without making excuses, being angry at yourself or anyone else, and simply saying, in this moment, I'm choosing to exercise the power to be happy against everything and everyone that may not want to align with that. So therefore, I will align with that which supports my being happy, which is a state of mind. I don't need a relationship to be happy, but if I'm with another person who's happy and I'm happy, then we have a happy relationship. Show me the person who was unhappy on their own who became happy in a relationship. Supply the need and take away the word love, and you have the reality of most people's relationship. If they said, I need you, they're being honest. If they say, I love you, they're not. Take away the supplying of that need and then see the reaction of the emotion. And then you start to understand how deep this goes. I just finished an 800-page manuscript on this. It's going to my publisher tomorrow. I hope that it will be meaningful to people who want a different way of looking at this. It was interesting because at the end of this conversation, the psychologist said, well, I hadn't thought about this. I don't want to give it away because there's five new insights I've gained that have not been written about that I have found anywhere. And I shared them. He said, well, I'm going to think about this because it's different. And I said, well, just be honest. How many people who are depressed are today happy because of the therapy? He said, well, that's not our goal. Our goal is not to get them happy. Our goal is to get them not to react in a depressive way or to be able to live in a more harmonious way with inside of their depression. And this high idea that we have to maintain all imbalance and adapt to the imbalance is like saying, do you want to walk out of the prison or do you want to decorate the walls? Most people would rather decorate the walls. And that's why we're such a mess. Tell you about how much of a mess we are. Just saw a film. I recommend it. It is not an easy film to watch. It's a very painful film. It's called 99 Homes. It's a small film. Brilliantly acted and written. It's about the foreclosures of happening in 2010 and how one man profits from it by exploiting it, and a man who was thrown out of his home goes to work for the man who repossessed his home because he had no other work he could do, and then how he becomes a part of the problem. Because it was showing all these people losing their homes, but no one asking, why did you lose them? At what point did you realize you were living beyond your means? You were living precariously. Did you pay attention to the liar's loans? Yes, they lied to get the commissions. You lied on when you signed your signature, you were making $150,000 a year to get the mortgage when you're making $30,000. Do we even have the capacity to have a discussion on how the American dream has been a lie for the last 25 to 30 years? It was a dream from the 1940s to the mid-70s. Since then, it hasn't. Why do we make that the high point of a person's life, getting a home, getting some brick and mortar somewhere, some 1,500, 3,000 square feet? Why is that important? Why aren't other things important? Why didn't anyone protest? Why didn't any major legislator protest? The President of the United States put a moratorium on home foreclosures. Why didn't neighbors do more than look out the window at the marshals taking people out of their homes and the people's belongings being stacked? Why didn't they go over? Why didn't we care about each other? Why did we abandon our spiritual base? Are we ready to have that conversation? I'd like to have that conversation. I think it's long overdue, the responsibility the individuals have individually and that of a society collectively, and as a extraordinarily abusive and corrupt political economic system to exploit people's fears and insecurities. It all adds together. I'm Gary Nall, back in a moment. Please stay with us.
Someday, some way, you'll realize that you've been blind. Yes, darling, you're going to need me again. It's just a matter of time. Go on, go on, until you reach the end.
Nice to have you all with us. In a few moments, we're going to be speaking with Ray McGovern and talking about the crisis in the Middle East, Russia, the United States, what Russia's been able to do in the last 6 days that America hasn't done in the last 2 years, and why we're angry at Russia having some success with ISIS and trying to destroy Russia's reputation in the process. Wow. How many monkeys can you get in this game in Washington, D.C. to play basketball? It is just stupid in the extreme. We'll deal with it. But first, I want to mention that from our environmental segment, from Jonathan Benson, Roundup causes cancer. Monsanto hid evidence for 40 years while lying to and defrauding Americans. This is from Jonathan Benson from Natural News. Quote, the downfall of the Monsanto chemical empire could go down in history as having had its official launch in 2015, the year that its flagship herbicide Roundup was found by the World Health Organization to be a probable cause of cancer in humans. 2015 is also the year that it was revealed that Monsanto has been hiding the dirty details of this deadly chemical formula from regulatory authorities for nearly 40 years. an independent research scientist by the name of Anthony Samsel, procured some 15,000 pages worth of documents from Monsanto covering the full gamut of research on Roundup, the most widely used herbicide in the world, and the information contained in these pages isn't pretty. In essence, Monsanto has known full well for 40 years that Roundup and glyphosate are linked to organ damage and cancer, and yet this information was withheld from the public purview as, quote, proprietary trade secrets. As a member of the Union of Concerned Scientists, Samsel has spent much of his career studying the toxicological effects of bioactivity of Roundup. Based upon a cohort of scientific data, he has come to the conclusion that Monsanto purposefully failed to submit to regulators evidence showing that glyphosate isn't as safe or biodegradable as the company claims. Quote, Monsanto misrepresented the data, so he said, deliberately covering up data to bring the product glyphosate to market. All right, so what do we do about it? I suggest that we demand a boycott of all Monsanto products and ask for a official investigation into this 40-year cover-up, according to Samsel, and let the public see the truth. I believe that we're all concerned when we are doing things to other people, other nations, that any other nation having done would be considered wrong. We are proud of our American exceptionalism, and indeed there's a lot of things to be proud of. We have done an enormous amount of good on so many levels. But of late, in the last 15 to 20 years, it seems that a disproportionate amount of our energies and research and effort has gone into the military-industrial complex, funding wars, funding regime change, funding all these situations, and the American media has been complicit. It never challenges it in any meaningful way. So before our guest gets on the line today, Ray McGovern, I'm going to share some insights, just things that are thinking points. The U.S. military spending dwarfs that of the domestic spending. We have a need for about $3 trillion to be spent on infrastructure that could also employ over 5 million people to a living wage, helping to rebuild bridges and dams and sewer systems, water treatment systems, regrowing trees. There's a lot we could do to make the United States viable again with our infrastructure. We could also go in and de-ghettoize cities. I had a meeting here yesterday with Gerald Salante and others, how we're going to try to take a block, one city block in Camden, New Jersey, and completely redo it, showing what is possible, using only people from the neighborhood and doing it without government help to show that we can de-ghettoize America if given the opportunity. And then show, okay, if we can do it here, we can do it in every city in America. Here's the plans. Here's the blueprints. It's like running the 4-minute mile. No one believed it was possible. All the scientists said it wasn't possible. They were absolutely certain of it until Bannister in 1958 did a 358 mile, and suddenly, shortly thereafter, 10 other people did it. What were they waiting on? Someone to do it. So when we talk about exceptionalism, how about bringing the Marshall Plan back to the United States? Let's rebuild America. All right, we have to rebuild America. The number and percentage of its children that live in poverty and have poor access to health care and quality foods, the number of its citizens who are overweight and obese and morbidly obese. We have the fattest children in the world and the most children with adult diabetics. We have more adult diabetic children, meaning they have type 2 diabetes in children, than in India or China. And look at the number of children there compared to here. We have the highest number of drugged up and traumatized military veterans, and we have more veterans committing suicide daily than any other nation in the world. The number of psychiatrically drugged white adolescent boys who are the perpetrators behind the uniquely American school shooting epidemic. We are exceptional in blaming guns and not psychiatric drugs, yet every one of these mass murders have been on psychiatric drugs. Why are we so exceptional in avoiding looking at that truth? The number of fully vaccinated children who became chronically ill with autoimmune disorders, thanks to the aluminum immune stimulating, indeed overstimulating adjuvants that are in the inoculum, and yet we deny anything's wrong with vaccines. The number of its citizens that are hopeless and sometimes suicidal, saddled with unpayable credit card debt and not able to discharge their student loan debt. That's exceptional. The number of college students who do not have jobs near the areas they've studied for and now have to work at a job that has nothing to do with their education, and yet they're saddled with the debt. The number of increasingly unhealthy citizens who are saddled with unpayable health care costs instead of having what is humane and reasonable, a universal health care. The number of citizens who also are seen as non-viable. It's now 240 million. The widest divide in the history of the world between the wealthy economic elite in the upper 1% and the lower 99% who are having their diminishing wealth extracted from their pockets in many ways. The number of brain-altered and thus impoverished people who qualify for total and permanent Social Security disability due to psychiatric prescription drug, neurotoxicity, and addiction. Yeah. Why are we incapable of looking at America's pseudo-exceptionalism? And I believe the answer lies in a couple of areas. Contemporary history is neither a series of random occurrences nor the predetermined plaything of a small cabal of super-empowered conspirators. The truth is somewhere in between. A sizable cadre of class and system-conscious deep state and imperial planners from the heights of concentrated private and governmental power joined together to shape the outlines of much of recent history. Along with professional class so-called experts. As I mentioned at the beginning of this program, when you watch Al Jazeera, almost every single person they have on is from the Brookings Institute or the Council on Foreign Relations or the Heritage Foundations. These are all neoliberal, philosophically based institutions. I do not question that the people who come on the air believe in what they say. I don't question that Dick Cheney or George Bush or Paul Wolfowitz or Richard Pearl, any of the other neocons, believe in their philosophy. The trouble is their belief should not be the empowering issue, but truth should be the empowering issue. And in this respect, Paul Street has it right when he says that along with professional class experts agreeable to their basic aims, they do so in accord with their shared interests in the endless upward accumulation of wealth and power. They serve the profit systems that still headquartered primarily in the United States, even as it develops ever more and varied outposts around this globalized world. They exercise vastly disproportionate influence on the course of events and policy, largely behind the scenes, in the darkly deceptive name of democracy. But it isn't about conspiracy. That's where I believe that some of the people on the left and the right have gotten it wrong. They're looking for the Bilderberg Group to have been responsible for everything, and it's not. Or the Trilateral Commission, and it's not. The planners are numerous. Their names and activities and backgrounds and the record of their influence are all open to investigate by those with the time, skill, and energy to do so. You have to have a willingness to make the connections. What do I mean? It's about class power and the unelected and interrelated dictatorships of money, wealth, and empire that rule beneath and beyond the pretense of popular governance. Who was it? Wasn't it Supreme Court Justice Louis Brandeis who wrote back in 1941, "We may have democracy or we may have wealth concentrated in the hands of few, but we cannot have both." Yes, it's about capitalism and its evil twin, which is imperialism. with strong doses of racism, patriarchy, nationalism, police statism, ecocidism, all thrown in. It's about what Karl Marx called the bourgeois' need of a constant expanding market over the whole surface of the globe. Capital, the German left Marxist Rosa Luxemburg once observed, needs the means of production and the labor power of the whole world for untrampled accumulation. Nowhere is the planning and influence of the ruling class of the world's and history's most powerful capitalist state, the United States, more evident than in what I've been saying for decades, the Council of Foreign Relations. There are hundreds of institutions and organizations which elite planning and networking occurs both at home and abroad, but as the left historian Shope shows in his indisputable new book, Wall Street's Think Tank, The Council on Foreign Relations and the Empire of Neoliberal Geopolitics, no such group remotely approximates this Council on Foreign Relations in scale, research, reach, the influence when it comes to articulating the national and global class interest of the U.S., the capitalist elite, and of growing transnational capitalist ruling class. And with individual membership of 5,000, with their average income of $1.4 million, a top Fortune 500 corporation membership of 170, a staff of 330, a budget of $60 million, and $490 million in assets, the Council, quote, is the largest, most powerful of all U.S. private think tanks that presume to discuss and decide the future of humanity in largely secret meetings behind closed doors in the upper-class neighborhoods of New York and Washington. And during the last four decades, the Council on Foreign Relations has not only successfully continued its central position as the most important private organization in the United States, one with no real peer in the country, it has succeeded in expanding its key role and remains at the center of the small plutocracy that runs the U.S. and much of the world, end quote. Now, consistent with that description, the Council on Foreign Relations members have long played prominent roles in the U.S. executive branch. Some among the many examples would be in President Jimmy Carter's cabinet, his Secretary of the Treasury, Michael Blumenthal, the National Security Advisor, Zbigniew Brzezinski, Secretary of State Cyrus Vance, the Arms Control Director Paul Wernicke, Vice President Walter Mondale, Secretary of Defense Harold Brown, CIA Director Stanford Turner, President Ronald Reagan's Secretaries of State Alexander Haig and George Shultz, and the National Security Advisor Colin Powell, and Frank Carlucci, Secretary of the Treasury, Donald Reagan, Secretaries of Defense, Caspar Weinberger, and Frank Carlucci, CIA Directors William Casey and William Weber, 10 of the Council on Foreign Relations members, and George W. Bush's 11 top foreign policymakers, 95%, 15 of the Council on Foreign Relations members, and Bill Clinton's top 17 foreign policymakers, along with two of the three of the Clintons' Treasury Secretaries, 14 of George W. Bush's top foreign policy officials, 12 of Obama's top foreign policy positions alone were from Council on Foreign Relations members in five of his domestic policy cabinet positions. So you're talking about the most powerful group of people on the planet. You're talking about the people that control the media. They control the think tanks. They control domestic and foreign policy. And they do it all in plain sight. The Council on Foreign Relations possesses an unrivaled and vast domestic network of overlapping membership and directors with other leading nonprofit think tanks and policy groups, the Brookings Institute, the Carnegie Institute, the Wilson Center, the American Enterprise Institute, the Heritage Foundation, the Peterson Institute for International Economics, the RAND Corporation, and many more. Do you really think they have your interests at stake? Do you think they're talking about how to help the poor, middle-class, working-class Americans in their meetings? Is that what you think? Other private policy groups, including the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, the Business Council, the Business Roundtable, they're all linked. Leading lobbying firms, top Fortune 500 corporations, top private equity and non-bank investment firms, the top for-profit strategic political risk and advisory corporations, including Kissinger Associates, and they're a leading university, Harvard, they're in their pocket, Yale, in their pocket. Major foundations, the Rockefeller Foundation, top corporate media, including numerous key connections with the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, and the Washington Post. The Council on Foreign Relations Studies program generated more than 180 books between 1987 and 2014, and less than 1,800 academic journal articles between 1993 and 2014. The Council on Foreign Relations regular monthly journal, Foreign Affairs, is the single most influential of all print media publications among government policymakers. The Council on Foreign Relations fellows regularly publish opinion editorials and appear in broadcast media to advance the neoliberal agenda, the imperial agenda. The organization holds nearly 1,000 meetings a year, mainly in New York and Washington, but also in numerous other large cities across the U.S. And the Council on Foreign Relations leaders engage in countless informal consultations and briefings with U.S. and foreign government leaders at home and abroad. Consistent with the emergence over the past four decades of this small but increasingly integrated transnational capitalist class, in some respects worldwide ruling class, the Council on Foreign Relations has, since the 1970s, developed a large number of international networks with wealthy and powerful superclass individuals and groups around the world. Relevant institutions here include its British counterpart and sister group, the Royal Institute of International Affairs, the elite European Bilderberg Group, the heavily corporate-permeated Trilateral Commission, combining U.S., European, and Japanese elites who joined together to combat this so-called excess of democracy. The G30, the Group of 30, a private gathering of top private and public financial authorities from across the Europe and Asia and the United States. The Council on Foreign Relations International Advisory Board, headed by super wealthy capitalists from around the world. And the Global Council on Foreign Relations, bringing together the top neoliberal think tanks from the world's richest 20 nations. No societal stratum has been more prominently and influentially represented in the Council on Foreign Relations than the top section of the U.S. capitalist class. With one possible partial exception, all the organization's top 10 leaders over the past 40 years have come from the capitalist elite, and especially from Wall Street. David Rockefeller, heir to the greatest family fortune in history, head of Chase Manhattan Bank, and the Council on Foreign Relations chair from 1970 to 1985. Peter Peterson, the billionaire co-founder of the private equity firm Blackstone Group, and the Council on Foreign Relations chair from 1985 to 2007. The current Council on Foreign Relations chair, Robert Rubin, former CEO of Goldman Sachs and Citigroup, Bill Clinton's Treasury Secretary and advisor to top Obama administration economic policymakers. He was the chair, a co-chair since 2007. The capitalist, working-oriented nature of the Council on Foreign Relations is something the body does not like to advertise about itself. One of its longtime senior fellows and top intellectuals, Michael Mandelbaum, readily acknowledges 10 years ago that, quote, the relatively small foreign policy elite sets the general course of the U.S. foreign policy with little or no input from the wider public. Yeah. So you want to know where a lot of our problems originate? You want to know the people really controlling the world and America and our policy? Well, that gives you an inside look. Let's now go to our guest who's standing by, and he has been on this program many times, and he's here to talk about these issues, Ray McGovern. Nice to have you with us today, Ray.
Thank you, Gary. Glad to be with you.
Ray, if we look what is happening now in Syria, we see a dynamic occurring. In less than a week, it would seem that Russia has been able to inflict more damage on ISIS in Syria and some of the other fascist groups, or at the very least terrorist groups, including al-Nusra, all of whom were trying to unseat Assad so they could take over the country. And I would presume that if any of these pro-American groups, pro-John McCain groups, pro-we-love-you State Department groups and Hillary Clinton groups, if any of them got control, we would have another outcome like Libya. But it would work for the people who wanted to get rid of Libya, Syria, Iran, Iraq, Afghanistan, and Somalia, among other nations, going clear back to the 1990s. Tell us about what you see as what is happening now in Syria with Russia, and what is the likely outcome?
Well, you're quite right. These plans go back to the 90s, and it wouldn't be so difficult for people to understand how this all evolved, were it not for the mainstream media disguising or suppressing all this information. Right now, we have a real game changer. Putin and his advisors have decided to jump into the Syrian situation, and they do so in a uniquely favorable way, since under international law, the only way you can do this is with a UN blessing or request of an embattled government. Now, if Assad, the Bashar al-Assad's government, is anything, it's embattled with all kinds of terrorists trying to take it over, including ISIS, including al-Nusra, including other vestiges of al-Qaeda, and including the so-called Free Syrian Army, which includes, quote, moderate rebels, end quote. You know, it's almost ludicrous because Obama himself a year ago said, that's a fantasy. There aren't any moderate rebels, okay? So what the Russians are doing is springing to the defense of Assad. They're bombing not only ISIS, mind you, but other even closer foes of Assad. And they're doing that at the request of the Syrian government. That's big, because the people who are funding rebels are people like Saudis and the Gulf states that are actually equipping and funding ISIS. That's against the international law from the word go. And, you know, CIA doesn't work under international law, but that doesn't gainsay the fact that international law still exists. So the Russians occupy the principled approach to this thing, and they're out to defend Assad by getting rid of the near rebels and the far rebels. And if some of these near rebels include the handful of people that we've thoroughly vetted, we being the United States, in Jordan and Turkey, we ran them through polygraphs and we did all kinds of background investigations. And then the first thing they did when they went back into Syria is surrender their arms to the bad guys, and the good guys became gray guys, and now they're bad guys again. So what we have here is a situation where Russia is in there for good. It's not going to put ground forces in there. Now, this is a big Fox News expose today. Russians and Iranians are throwing in ground troops. The Russians are, not stupid enough to fail to remember what happened in Afghanistan. And they've looked at what ground troops have done in Iraq, U.S. ground troops or coalition ground troops, and they say that this is a fool's errand. So what the foreign ministry spokesperson said today in the Kremlin was simply that, look, let us remind you that we're there at the request of the Syrian government, and we're coordinating closely with Syrian ground forces. This cannot be won without ground forces, but there are Syrian ground forces, and Bashar al-Assad still has an army. So they're the dais cast. Now, what's the implications here for us? Well, Obama has a choice. Now, he was able to face down the ideologues on the nuclear deal with Iran. It surprised me. I was very pleasantly surprised that went through. Now, the question is, would he be able to do that now with the same ideologues, the same people who want chaos in Syria and elsewhere in the Middle East, or whether he'll take this as an opportunity rather than a challenge? And what I mean by that is this. Iran has become respectable, okay? The Russians are in there at the invitation of the Syrian government, and they have a common aim, to stem the rebels. Now, unfortunately, those include the rebels that we tried to equip, train, and so forth, but they're still rebels, and the Russians are in it. Now, they have actually said that there would be a place for moderate rebels, if there are any, at the conference table. So what I see Moscow doing is changing the game so that the U.S. will have to come off this sticky wicket, which says Assad must go. Now, you remember Hillary Clinton saying that 3 years ago, Assad must go for the good of mankind, or something, some words to that effect. That is a non-starter. You can't have a conference table that that you say can't be attended if your precondition is that the president of the existing government has to go. Now, it looks like, well, this is hopefully not unreasonable hoping, but Obama has been relatively restrained in the way he's acted. Now, not in the way he's rhetoricized, not in the way he's spoken, because he still adopts this this very bellicose attitude toward not only Bashar al-Assad, but Putin. But the way he's acted has been relatively restrained so far, especially given Putin's, well, you could even call it embarrassing move, where the way the U.S. was informed that Russian fighter bombers were going to do their work in Syria was a three-star general appeared where? Washington? Brussels? No. He appeared in Baghdad at our embassy there, and he said, oh, by the way, in an hour, our planes are going to do a real strike against rebels against Assad, and we just, you know, would ask you, please, keep your planes away from ours, and we'll talk this through later. So, what happened? Well, what you saw was a reasonably mild reaction on the part of Obama and John Kerry, who got up and said, yes, we're getting our military together right away to deconflict, okay? In other words, we don't want Russian planes running into Americans and vice versa. We're going to deconflict this thing. And that's a hopeful sign, because it could have been a much more bellicose reaction. And once the Russians are able to persuade Obama that Iran and Russia and the U.S. can coordinate their actions, if the U.S. comes off this insistence that Assad has to go like today, then there's a possibility that Russia will not completely win the game, because the Russians have set up a coordination center with four people, okay? Russia, Iran, Syria, and Iraq, in Baghdad. So they're deconflicting things in Baghdad. They have a wonderful target list, part of which has been provided by the Iraqis, courtesy of the United States. And so the Russians are in there big time, and they're coordinating with three of the major players. Now, what the U.S. needs to do, if it has any sense at all, is to give up this idea of these moderate rebels succeeding in overthrowing Assad, because just as with Ukraine, Putin said, about a year ago, if you want the eastern Ukrainians to be obliterated, quote, we will not allow it, period, end quote. He's saying that now, and he's saying that with more than words. You see, if you want to remove Bashar al-Assad now and risk the danger of ISIL coming in, can you imagine ISIL coming in and dominating Syria, quote, we will not allow it, end quote. Now, that last quote is being said in strikes by Soviet fighter bomber aircraft and more support for the Syrian army. Don't expect the Russians to send their own troops in. Do expect them to send even more advisors, as they did, you know, for those who have some memory, as they did to a limited extent in Vietnam when they supported Ho Chi Minh.
You also have a missing element here, and that is China coming in also with some major warships to support Syria. And so now you have China, Russia, Iran. There's no way that ISIL is going to win, nor al-Nusra, and probably most of their strategic positions that have been in place for at least a year, they'll be dislodged from those places. It won't end, but at least it'll give the opportunity to get rid of an awful lot of terrorist groups so that Syria does not become the next Libya.
That's hopefully the case, Gary. It's going to take some time, though. You know, the rebels, whatever stripe they may bear, are not susceptible to pressure from the outside. It's a similar situation to the one in Ukraine, where even if Poroshenko wanted to do what most people are telling him to do, now he's got fascists that he's going to contend with. He's got real problems out there in the eastern Ukraine and in Odessa and places like that. So what I'm saying here is that the people who are running ISIL cannot really be contained without really prolonged bombing on a coordinated basis. Witness the fact that over a year's worth of bombing has caused very little, well, has not stopped ISIL's advance at all. So it's going to take people sitting around the table, and I've been advocating this, as you probably remember, for months now. Why is it? Why is it that at this point in time, we don't do what history suggests? That is, you get the stakeholders to Geneva or to Vienna or to Paris. You sit around the table. And if you look at the stakeholders here, most of them, the vast majority, don't want ISIL to succeed. Now, Saudi Arabia, the UAE, Israel. Yeah, Israel's sort of in betwixt and between. They'd like to see, as they have admitted, you know, nobody win. Keep the Sunni and Shia at each other's throats, and there's no threat from Syria. They said that, okay? The others all want ISIS not to win in a sensible way. And so what they need to do is decide, okay, not only are we going to coordinate this offensive against ISIL, but we're going to tell Saudi Arabia, we're going to tell Turkey, we're going to tell the UAE in no uncertain terms, knock it off. Knock off the supply of arms and equipment and money to these crazy people. Knock it off and knock it off now. Now, there are enough people and enough strong people, including Iran, including the U.S. And Russia, to drive that home. And they haven't done that so far. But now, with the game changing, I have some hope that that will happen.
Well, if we ever see the Saudi people rise up against the corrupt regime, that's a game changer, because the Saudis are the principal financiers and trainers of all these terrorist groups and organizations, and that we call them our ally, and then we put them ahead of the Human Rights Commission. How insane is that at the UN? Ray, we're out of time. Thank you very much. RayMcGovern.com or ConsortiumNews.com. Always nice
to
have
you
on. I'm Gary Null. We're out of time. Look forward to sharing more tomorrow. Progressive Commentary Hour tonight, 7 p.m. Have a nice day, everyone.
They ask me how I knew my true love was true. Oh, I have replied, something here inside cannot be denied.